Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Tuesday, March 3rd, 2009. Welcome. And in order to accommodate the schedule of an agency director, I am actually reversing the order of the bills. We're going to start with Senate Bill 628. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 628 and ask Lori to give us an overview of the bill.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 628 establishes a mandatory foreclosure mediation program, and it specifies the procedures for that mediation. It delineates the contents of required notices for mediation and the procedure for the mediation, including foreclosure settlement. It defines a qualified mediator, sunsets on January 2nd, 2014, and it declares an emergency. It's effective on passage.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to invite Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, to come up. And as the director is coming up, I just want to make a couple comments about the actual bill, Senate Bill 628. This is intended to be an overview of the issue. It's one of those instances where we recognize that the bill does need some work. But we hope to start the discussion with the conversation and the hearing that we're having today and provide the framework and the concept for foreclosure mediation with a recognition that this bill will be amended as we go through the process. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate your accommodating my schedule by the take the hit from those in the audience who are wondering if the schedule get rearranged. I'm pleased to be here today to testify about this bill and to offer support for the concept of pre-foreclosure mediation and to talk a little about what's going on, particularly at the federal level, that I think makes this very timely right now. We all know, of course, that foreclosures are on the rise in Oregon. In the third quarter of 2008, we had about 8,400 households in foreclosure, and that's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. It was an increase of 130% year over year from the same quarter in 2007. And we don't have fourth quarter data yet, but we do expect that that number will be up considerably. Realty Track, which tracks foreclosure rates across the country, now has us with our foreclosure rate increasing at the fifth highest nationally. So for quite a while, we were trailing the rest of the country, but unfortunately, our rate is picking up. One of our strategies for responding has been to encourage borrowers and lenders to work together to see whether a loan modification is possible. And if a loan modification is practical under the circumstances, it can work to the benefit of the borrower and the lender both. Foreclosure is generally, particularly in today's market, with the real estate having slowed down as much as it has, foreclosure is not really an attractive option for the lender any more than it is for the borrower. So a lot of the work that we've been doing has been to make borrowers available aware of their options, to encourage them to get in touch with lenders. We have made access to HUD counselors more available to assist borrowers in knowing what their options are. We've increased the funding for those counselors. Legislation passed by this body in the February 2008 session, House Bill 3630, made sure that borrowers get good information about their options when they're facing foreclosure. But despite all of these efforts, many borrowers still have trouble getting in touch with a representative of their lender who has the ability and the authority to negotiate about their loan. And although a number of lenders have initiated loan modification programs, many of those programs have not provided a great deal of relief to borrowers thus far. In some cases, the requirements have simply been too stringent, and that includes the federally sponsored loan modification programs. And in other cases, the modification simply hasn't resulted in significant change to the borrower's monthly payments so that the modification has resulted in default again after a short period of time. The Obama administration has responded with a number of new initiatives, some of which are aimed at making loan modifications work. These modifications make the timing of Senate Bill 628 particularly important, and I'd like to talk a little about what some of those federal initiatives are. And I will say up front that the details are not in our hands yet. The rulemaking is underway now, and I believe, in fact, tomorrow we are supposed to get detailed information about the program. But I can tell you what we know so far, and we've also attached to my testimony the explanation of some of these programs from the White House and the Department of Treasury. In particular, I want to talk about the Homeowner Stability Initiative, which makes $75 billion. I believe my testimony says million. I believe it is billion. It is billion. Excuse me. I have trouble with some of these numbers when I get too large. $75 billion in funding available at the federal level. And so here are some of the components in that program. In order to participate, a lender would first be responsible for bringing the interest rates down, not the principal, but the interest rates, so that the borrower's monthly payment would be no more than 38% of his or her income. If the lender's willing to do that, then the federal government steps in and matches further reductions in the interest rate dollar for dollar to bring the monthly payment down to no more than 31% of income. The lower interest rate would stay in place for 5 years, after which it could be stepped up to market rates for conforming loans. The lender could also reduce the principal owed on the loan with some cost sharing by the federal government. Loan servicers, who are often the major contact for the borrower because the loans tend to have been resold in the secondary market, potentially securitized with multiple people owning the loan, the loan servicer as the main contact then has incentives to make loan modifications work. They can obtain an upfront fee of $1,000 for each eligible modification, and they also get pay-for-success fees of up to $1,000 per year for 3 years if the borrower stays current after the modification. So it's an incentive to put together a modification that is workable for the borrower. Borrowers are also eligible for direct assistance in making loan payments. Again, if they stay current on the loan, they can get assistance up to $1,000 per year for 5 years. Servicers can obtain incentive payments of $500, and mortgage holders, that is the actual creditor, can obtain incentive payments of $1,500. If they modify mortgages before the borrower becomes delinquent. So it's an incentive to identify problem loans early. And to encourage lenders to participate, the holders of the mortgages would also get some level of federal guarantee of the loans guaranteed against further declines in the housing market. One of the challenges for a lender is that if the housing market is declining, the loan may be underwater, that is, more owed on the loan than the home is worth, and the lender may be unwilling to take the full risk of housing prices dropping further, so this would put the federal government in place for a portion of that risk. As part of this initiative, the Treasury will develop uniform guidelines for loan modifications, building on work that's already been done by the FDIC. I believe that the printed bill refers to the FDIC loan modification guidelines, but there will be new and better guidelines coming, and they will be designed for use across all segments of the financial industry. The federal plan to stabilize the mortgage market contains a number of other elements in addition to this loan modification program. There are refinance opportunities through Fannie and Freddie, and there are some other elements which are summarized in the attachments. And again, we do expect to be learning more about this program shortly. In light of these initiatives, though, it is fairly clear that there are opportunities now that have not been available before for mortgage modifications that are designed to be successful for the borrower and for the lender. So a very useful step we can take as a state is to help bring borrowers and lenders together to explore those opportunities and to take advantage of them where appropriate. So we do understand several other states have successfully implemented mediation programs similar to the concept proposed by Senate Bill 628, and we do think that it has the potential to provide an opportunity for borrowers to get assistance in a way that works for both borrower and lender. We will have some suggestions regarding the details of the bill and how the program could work, and we would look forward to discussing those with you. And, of course, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and I'm looking forward to seeing the details of the federal plan as well so we can make sure that what we're doing is consistent. Are there any questions? Any questions? No, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I'd like to call a panel, Angela Martin, Matt Wallace, and Melissa Briggs, please.
Good
Welcome.
Afternoon.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you so much. Angela Martin with Our Oregon, here today speaking in support of Senate Bill 628. As the foreclosure crisis continues to spin out of control, we must turn to state policymakers to help put the brakes on and stop all preventable foreclosures from proceeding along our destructive path. We already heard some of the numbers. In the packet that I passed out, I'd like to call your attention to a few more that I think really spell out where we are. I don't know if your packets have reached you yet. I will proceed, though. Current efforts to stop foreclosures through voluntary loan modifications are simply not keeping pace with the rising rate of defaults. For example, Hope Now Alliance servicing data from the third quarter 2008 revealed that while loan modifications as a share of workouts have increased, workouts still fall short of the need. During the period, there were 14,000 seriously delinquent mortgages and 4,000 foreclosure filings and fewer than 2,000 loan modifications. And again, I provided you a very colorful handout so you can see these numbers for yourself. Part of the reason for this gap is the misaligned incentives. Servicers often earn more when they foreclose than when they modify the loan. The lender or the mortgage holder under this current environment earns more when the loan is modified than foreclosed. And the homeowner who could make payments under a reasonable modification obviously wins when they're able to sit down, come together, and work on a modified loan product. We heard testimony that at the federal level, some of these misaligned incentives are being corrected, but we still do look to the state to help start that conversation and bring the two parties together. In the testimony, I provided a chart, kind of a snapshot of where we are currently in Oregon, and I found this helpful. I hope you will as well. You'll see in the numbers, we're looking at about 64,000 homeowners that are in the riskiest products, subprime and Alt-A loans. Of those, another number I want to point out, 14,000 still have a prepayment penalty in force. This acts as the anchor holding this loan in place, that if the homeowner that starts to realize that they're getting into trouble may want to consider a refinance into a more reasonable loan, this is going to be a heavy tax on that ability to refinance, making modifications more affordable and more successful. Some other numbers that I want to point out. I show here how many loans have missed payments, late payments, and are in foreclosure, so those are currently at risk. At the very bottom of this chart, the last three columns show us the percent of these loans, the adjustable rate loans, which will be resetting in the near future. So these are the group of loans that we could be, that are going to be at risk fairly soon, that we can reach out to and create an incentive to bring them together with their lender. around the country, we have seen more states getting creative and creating pre-foreclosure programs that mandate both parties come together. One of those jurisdictions is Philadelphia. In your packet, I included a editorial about the Philadelphia program. I had the opportunity to speak with some of the folks on the ground in Philadelphia and ask how this program is going. A couple of things stand out. Program updates since October 2008 show that the program prevented or delayed foreclosure in 80% of the cases that went to mediation, so quite successful. The most important component of their program is the fact that it's required. Again, voluntary efforts simply have not produced this level of success. Another important component of this program was the aggressive person-to-person outreach. ACORN was one of the groups that took on actually physically going to the doors of homeowners who qualified for this mediation, explaining the program to them and encouraging them to participate. What ACORN found in this original batch, Only 4% of owner-occupied households were already working with a foreclosure counselor. I think that's a pretty stark figure. Other things that they found, 80% of the people that they were able to make contact with 80% of the owner-occupied households. 96% of those contacted in person scheduled a pre-foreclosure meeting, and 77% completed the pre-foreclosure meeting. Those are statistics that would spell real success for homeowners here in Oregon, and what Senate Bill 628 is designed to accomplish. The last thing I'll touch on before I close, I think it's important to understand that the goal of pre-foreclosure mediation isn't to simply bail out a homeowner. It is to find a solution that answers the question, how do we keep the lender whole, or as whole as possible, and the homeowner as whole as possible, finding that balancing point. I think it was spelled out best that the goal of the loan modification would be to provide more income to the investor than a foreclosure of the home, and the loan modification payments that are affordable to the homeowner and lower than the current loan requires. In closing, I want to thank you for considering this. I look forward to talking with you all more about the details of the bill and urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And before we take Matt's testimony, I just want to say, Ms. Briggs, I didn't see a check mark by your name when you checked in, so I'm going to actually have you testify with the next panel. So you're welcome to sit there and wait, or you could take a seat and come back up in just a minute. So, Matt, go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Wallace, consumer advocate with Osberg. Thanks again, of course, for the opportunity to talk before you today about this extremely important issue. I wanted to focus my spoken comments on some of the shortfalls that we've seen in voluntary loan modifications up to this point, and why we think state action is necessary and appropriate and a real benefit. But before I did that, I wanted to add one more detail that better describes sort of a picture of the problem that we're facing. We know that foreclosures are up, and again, some counts put us at fifth in the nation just last month. And again, just want to reiterate, and I think I've said this to you all before, this is not just a problem about keeping some people in their homes, although that's certainly very, very important. It's very much also about stabilizing the housing markets and stabilizing the economy. We know that increased foreclosures contribute greatly to the glut in housing supply that's really causing home prices to plummet. And in fact, you know, some counts put that every foreclosure in a neighborhood in a certain radius at about a $5,000 decrease for the value of surrounding homes, and that's a cumulative effect for those foreclosures. So pretty conservative projections from last year, given the number of subprime and Alt-A foreclosures that we can expect over the next year or so, add up to a total loss of about $2.5 billion in home value just over the next year or so in terms of home value loss, and that report's cited in my testimony as well, and you can take a look at some of those numbers. But we know that's bad news, and we're already sort of seeing the effects in the housing market, of course, as we all know. And in fact, one of the latest updates is not only are home prices down, but home sales just in the Portland metro area alone, not necessarily the worst area hit in the state by the foreclosure crisis, are down to record low levels this last January. So a little bit of context there on the problem. And I wanted to add my support for the concepts in Senate Bill 628 precisely because we have an opportunity here at the state level to really help stop the bleeding, help keep people in their houses, and help stabilize the housing markets for everybody. And it is the case that current voluntary loan modifications from servicers and lenders across the country just haven't been enough. Angela gave you some state numbers from the Hope Now Alliance, and those are backed up by a lot of academic studies that have taken place on the national level. These are national figures, but we don't have a good reason to believe why they're radically different here in the state. We know that about 7 out of 10 seriously delinquent loans right now are not on track for modification. And we're also hearing from consumers that one of the first hurdles to achieving loan modifications is just getting a hold of someone at their lender or servicer who can actually even answer those questions. So one of the reasons that we're seeing that happen is just a lack of ability to actually talk to someone who might have an ability and authority to modify the loan when it's just between a proactive borrower who's in trouble and their servicer or lender. That hasn't been working. In fact, there's a story of a congresswoman from California attempting to achieve a loan modification for one of of her constituents who spent, you know, over 2 hours on the phone with U.S. Bank, getting through the phone tree to, you know, extensions that just, you know, didn't exist and so on and so forth, to no avail. And, you know, if a U.S. congressperson is having trouble getting somebody on the line, we know that regular homeowners are too. And in fact, we're hearing that from, you know, from our members and from other consumers who we're talking to are facing these problems, which is why, again, mediation is such, we think, a great step to add to the process, because it's a way to ensure that the borrower and the lender come to the table and actually, you know, plug in the financials, look at the loan, and figure out a way, where possible, to both keep the homeowner in their house, helping to protect housing values in their neighborhood as well, and then also, again, protecting that investment of the investors who, in many cases, own these loans. It's a win-win situation when it's done right, and we have, are very enthusiastic about the opportunity to encourage that here. But again, that was a bit of a sidetrack. Again, on the loan modifications nationally, we know these aren't working, and a couple more statistics for you to carry that home. Only 49%, according to one study, only 49% of modifications in a representative sample just from November 2008 actually report reduced monthly payments for modified home loans. And this is really important because actually reducing a monthly payment is sort of the key factor for whether that loan modification will be sustainable and will actually keep the borrower from going back into default a few months later. You may have heard some statistics, not in my testimony, but we're seeing, depending on how you count them, a lot of loan modifications end up back in default a few months later when they're not actually modified according to a set of criteria that ensures, again, reduced monthly payments for the borrower and, of course, a better investment for the investor. We're actually seeing 51% of voluntary loan modifications through November of 2008 either maintain monthly payments or actually increase them in about 34% of these cases. And again, this speaks to one of the details, which again we may discuss. It sounds like what's in the bill now, the FDIC loan modification process, may get updated a little bit as a result of some of the negotiations around the federal homeowner affordability and stability program. But we know that the key factors that you have to have in there that we're very encouraged are in there in the current bill as drafted are standards to reduce that monthly payment to a reasonable debt-to-income ratio and, of course, also maintain as much income for the investor as possible, especially when compared with foreclosure. And then I just wanted to take a moment now to note at the outset of the discussions that we're having, you know, the problems that we're seeing are the worst for loans that have been packaged up into the mortgage-backed securities that are now in infamous and sold on down the line to investors. And these loans are, of course, serviced by big national servicers all over the country. We're seeing less of a problem, and thankfully so, from small community-oriented banks and credit unions who hold these loans in portfolio. In those cases, as I believe we've heard in the informational session on foreclosures generally, you are seeing a lot of outreach for folks who actually hold those loans. But the fact that there's such a big gap between the banks and credit unions who hold loans, reaching out to homeowners early and modifying those loans where possible, and the rest of the market really shows, I think, the sort of mixed-up incentives that are making making such a mess of the situation that we have now. And again, as Angela outlined, you have a situation in many cases where the investors would benefit from modifying a loan, but the servicers may not. So again, bringing folks to the table and actually looking at those financials and figuring out a way to encourage the loan modifications where possible is a way to really, you know, make sure that most of those happen. So I'll wrap it up for there, and I just wanted to reiterate again, look forward to getting more details on the federal plan as those come out. But as far as we can see now, we are really encouraged by the possibility that the incentives in the Homeowner Affordability and Stability Program that Corey outlined will play very nicely with the state program in a way that will really make sure that the maximum number of homeowners, and by extension the maximum number of Oregon citizens, will really reap the benefits of loan modifications and mediation as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Any questions for Matt or Angela? Questions? Okay. Senator George.
Thank you both very much. I got a question around the timeliness of this piece of legislation. And so I'm trying to get at, and Angela, I'm sorry I didn't discuss this with you earlier when you were polite enough to come in and talk to me in my office, but is this a bill that works in this environment where we have lots of foreclosures, but in the normal market it's sort of out of place? What I mean by that is that I can see the need to sort of have this mediated situation with an elevated number of foreclosures in the market. However, in the normal market, you don't want to give borrowers the incentive knowing that they can, in essence, have a strike at modifying their loan or the contract. I mean, it is a contract in times of economic growth. In essence, what you're doing is, and to me, this may be an emergency bill that we put into place to deal with this crisis, but do you both see this as a long-term thing? Because I really see the damage when we return to a more stable housing market. Just comments?
Chair Bonamici, Senator George, thank you for the question. My recollection is that there is a sunset on this bill of 2014, recognizing that we are in a unique period right now with a heightened level of foreclosures that everyone is having a difficult time dealing with, that this is appropriate for the current situation.
I didn't see the sunset, so thank you very much.
It does sunset. It's intended to be for the situation that we're in now. Thank you very much for your testimony. And now I want to call up John Helmick and Paul Cosgrove. Sorry about that. When there's no indication of support or opposition, you are grouped with the panel, and I think you'll be more comfortable with them. And as you prepare to testify, I want to let you know, in case you weren't in the room at the beginning of the committee meeting today, this draft of Senate Bill 628 came back to us just recently. We know that there will be changes to it, so if you could focus on the concept rather than a lot of details, because there will be amendments to the bill as we go forward. Thank you very much. Want to go ahead, Melissa? Thank you.
All right. I'm Melissa Briggs. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. The bankers of Oregon are concerned with this bill for a number of reasons, and my testimony outlines in detail what the reasons are. I'll just go through a couple of points, and I recognize that we are looking at amendments, you know, and talk about concepts right now. And so most of my comments do talk about the technicalities, so I'll try to keep those brief. As a policy concern, I think what we're looking at is placing more burdens on lenders. This slows down the process, and it increases the cost for the lenders. And in this economic time that we're facing right now, when we're recognizing that to spur the economy, we need to get lenders lending again, creating more burdens and more costs are not the way to do that, not the way to encourage that. Another policy concern that we have is the involvement of DCBS and what sort of fiscal impact that creates. They're creating sort of a monitor for the mediation program and creating a DCBS as a court-like substitute, which we're wondering what the cost of that will be. Technically, just a few things that I'll comment on. First, the bill speaks to trustee. And the trustees' duties and trustees working with the mediation. And technically, it's the beneficiary that would be looking to do that. The trustee has no substantive place in the negotiation. It's just the beneficiary. Another concern is the delay. We have right now, we have 120 days. This moves it out to 180. And we understand that's probably to give time for the mediation, but we're wondering why that's necessary. Why can't the mediation, you know, if it has to occur within the 120 days? The bill also makes the mediation mandatory, but it doesn't provide any consequences for not showing up to the mediation. And often, you know, lenders are always working with borrowers to try to work things out. And often at this point, the borrower has gone silent. And so if we're talking about a borrower who has gone silent, is no longer willing to communicate for whatever reason, and we're requiring this mediation, and the beneficiary, the lender, goes there and spends the time and the money to do that, and the beneficiary is never showing up, what's the consequence? The grantor, the borrower, is never showing up. What's the consequence to that? There's some duplicative information that's required under the bill and the notices. There's three different notices that are going to be required. Why can't we make it all in one? Why can't we, you know, shorten some of the information that's being repeated? Some of the information about DCBS and the borrower being able to go to DCBS and say, hey, I didn't get this notice, you know, is there a time limit for when that happens? Can the borrower go to DCBS the day before the sale and say, hey, I didn't get this notice, and the sale is suspended, and then the lender has to come back in and say, no, here, we gave the notice, and what sort of information would that require? Those are just some of the overall concerns. And one thing that's not in my written testimony that I did notice was that the bill takes effect on passage, and I'm wondering what that does to trust deed foreclosures that are currently in the process. But other than that, I do recognize that we're going to have some changes to this, and so I just wanted to comment on a few things. But overall, I think that placing more burdens is not encouraging lending, which I think what we need to do right now.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I want to acknowledge that many of those things are things that we noticed when we got the bill back, but we were up against a deadline to get bills into the system. So we appreciate your comments, and we'll consider them. We'll go ahead and hear from the panel first, and then questions. Go ahead, Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. You heard from Corey Streisinger about the new federal programs that are going to provide aid to modifying loans. That's sort of the substance of the modification. This bill deals, of course, with the process of how you get from there to a modification. And in addition to agreeing with all the technical and policy concerns stated by Ms. Briggs, on behalf of the Oregon Financial Service Association, I think we have some additional concerns. Many Oregon lenders are small and community-based, credit unions and small community banks, but more often than not these days, given the mergers that we've all read about, lenders, even some that used to be local are no longer local, they're part of large organizations. And those organizations, including some of my members who are owned by national banks and other national financial institutions, have already entered into, in some cases, binding agreements with federal regulatory agencies, and in some cases, not necessarily binding agreements, but voluntary agreements with a variety of entities to do this certain kinds of processes to lead to modification. One of the concerns they have is, if states veer into their own state-specific processes, it makes it far more difficult to run an effective and efficient national program for all of their borrowers. So our concern is that, in fact, a state specific process may in fact be counterproductive into getting information out to borrowers in Oregon and all other states about the programs that are available to them and getting those modifications where appropriate implemented and put together. The second point I would make is, was asked to mention that the representative of the Oregon Title Insurance Association, who is I think still on the East Coast today and will be back tomorrow, I was asked to make the mention of this, and of course it's a very important issue for lenders. Once the foreclosure process is done, we rely on title insurance companies to make sure that we have clear title so that the property is resaleable. And I know from the brief information I received from one of the attorneys from the title insurance companies that they have major concerns about how they would be able to insure title under this bill. Now, maybe some of those issues will be addressed in the technical amendments that the chair is mentioning, but I would urge you to bring the title insurers into this conversation, because when you're dealing with the foreclosure process, from everybody's perspective, having insurable title at the end of the process, whatever the process is of course very important. Be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Helmick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Helmick. I'm the CEO of Gorilla Capital. We are the largest purchaser of foreclosure homes in Western Oregon. Gorilla Capital buys homes at foreclosure auction, repairs the home, and then sells the home at a highly affordable price. Last week, we were featured on CNBC News. We were called the Costco of homes. We're able to sell homes cheap because we buy them cheaper. In most instances, our fully repaired homes are priced $20,000 below all similar homes. In the past 2 years, Gorilla Capital has purchased, repaired, and sold over 150 foreclosure homes by outbidding the banks. By purchasing and repairing these homes, many of which were in significant disrepair, we help keep neighborhoods vibrant. As part of our business, Gorilla Capital tracks every one of the homes that goes into foreclosure in Western Oregon, and we go to every home. We're on the front lines of this foreclosure industry. Many of you might be surprised to know that in Oregon, less than 0.5% of all homes are sold at foreclosure auctions. In 2008, that was the total, less than 0.5%. You might also be surprised to learn that so far in 2009, we have yet to go to a foreclosure auction that was foreclosing a loan that was made prior to 2006. That's a little bit of information about the scope of this problem. I'm happy to answer any questions and serve as a resource to this committee on anything to do with foreclosure. Now let's talk a little bit more. My company employs 13 people. We provide good wages, health insurance, and a matching retirement plan. We are licensed, bonded, and insured. I'm not typically involved in the legislative process, but it came to my attention in early February that there were several bills in the legislature relating to foreclosure. I have two ideas for improving the law. But by early February, I found out that the deadline to submit bills and ideas to the Legislative Council had already passed. It appears my only option is to suggest amendments to a bill that is moving through the process. I thought I found such a bill with Senate Bill 241, the state bar's bill that is pending in the Senate Judiciary Committee. But when I submitted my suggestions to the state bar, and by the way, I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar, they suggested I wait 2 years and submit my own bill. Well, 2 years may not be long for a lawyer or for a legislator, but as a small business person, 2 years is an eternity. The primary focus of this bill, SB 682, is to require mediation between homeowners and lenders. That's not my interest, and although I do have a lot of thoughts on the matter, that's not what I'm here to speak about. I'm here to talk to you about the process by which foreclosures are noticed and sold. The current process is highly inefficient. Banks, homeowners, and the foreclosure industry would all benefit by a more efficient system. We're still conducting foreclosures in the same method as we did before the invention of internet technology. The best way to achieve the highest price for the lender and for the homeowner, and by the way, the homeowner receives any amount beyond what is due on the promissory note, is if as many potential bidders as possible know about the foreclosure auction and have the ability to attend and bid at the foreclosure auction. I have two recommended changes to the foreclosure law. First,
Mr. Homick, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you could just summarize those briefly, we'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. The current law is that trustees must deliver the trustee within 10 days of the foreclosure auction. I say trustees routinely take 20 days or more. I'm asking that a penalty of $100 per day be added to the legislation so that trustees have to abide by the statutes of Oregon. Second, when an auction is stayed by bankruptcy, the notice of the new date of the auction is not released. We need to have a provision whereby people who want to bid on that auction can write to the trustee of the trustee and ask for notice of when the new date for the auction is set. I've talked to Representative Paul Hovey and Republican Leader Bruce Hanna about my two suggestions, and I'm pleased to report that each of them thinks that these ideas merit consideration. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, and I see you've submitted some detailed information about that, so thank you for submitting that. And are there any questions for this panel? Any questions, anybody? Senator Burdick?
Yeah, Madam Chair, do you have any comments on other states that were referred to, especially Mr. Cosgrove, maybe Melissa? On other states that have this mandatory mediation, how it's working there?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I recognize that that was something that was mentioned by Ms. Dreisinger, and I don't have that information, but I intend to get it, and I will give it to you, committee staff, to provide to all of you. I have not heard that there are other states in which the system is working well. I've heard of a number of states who've proposed a number of things that have been of concern to the industry. So I will find out how many states have actually implemented something with mandatory mediation, and then, to the best of my ability, give you a report on how it's working.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And we have one more panel on this bill, and that is going to be Sybil Hebb and Stacey Howard, please. Welcome, and if you'll state your name for the record, please. And I don't know if you've decided who wants to go first. I'll leave that up to you.
My name is Stacey Howard.
Want to go ahead?
Thank you, Chairman Bonamici, and Senator George for allowing us to give testimony today in favor of House Bill 628. I'd like to say I am the Community Development and Homeownership Director for NEDCO. We're the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation. We're Oregon's oldest community development corporation. And about a year ago, we became foreclosure counselors, not because it was something that we wanted to do, but because part of what we do is have regional housing centers in Lane and Marion County. And we felt that part of the role of a regional housing center should be to provide foreclosure counseling. I didn't have time, because I was too busy doing foreclosure counseling, to do written testimony, but I did go through my last quarter's files and provide some statistics for the members of the committee. And I'd like to say that this is a problem that we had absolutely no idea of what the scope would be, and it's so different from what we were led to expect that it would be. 48% of the loans that people have who come to me in foreclosure are fixed-rate loans at less than 8% interest. In other words, these are prime loans. These are not subprime or Alt-A loans. 66% of the people who come to me for foreclosure counseling are there because of loss of income. They've either lost their jobs, they've had their hours reduced, they were on commission income. They had businesses in construction, or they have restaurants, and that the reason that they're in foreclosure is because of the economy, not because they got into a bad loan. I talked to a woman this morning whose home was sold last week in a foreclosure auction. Her name was on the note. She never knew that her home was sold until a realtor came knocking at her door. Now, the processes in her case were followed to the letter of the law. Her husband, who she really has no idea even how long he'll continue to be her husband, but her husband had successfully hidden all the notices from her and was in so much denial himself that he added a $1,000 front porch that he, you know, put on the front of the house a week before the foreclosure sale. Had there been some kind of mediation that had to happen before this sale, this woman, who is raising three kids and who has a very good job and could have made the payments, so she could have done a modification, she could make the payments, she could be in this loan, is looking for a place to live and possibly going to live with her parents because she's lost her home and she had no idea it was even going to happen. I don't think that her case is typical, but I can tell you that this is not the first time that I've heard of one owner hiding a foreclosure from another owner, whether it's spouse or whether it's some other circumstance. And to me, this law provides a safeguard for the homeowner in that they are guaranteed a place at the table to sit down and talk, everyone who's involved in this loan. The other thing that I would say is that it's very, very difficult to deal with the loan servicers. I had to learn very quickly how to maneuver through this minefield, and so one of the things that's happened is we've been to a lot of trainings. I'm on a network of other foreclosure counselors all around the country, and every day I get emails that say, does anybody have a contract at Countrywide? They're not returning my phone calls. Does anybody know how to get a hold of ACS? I can't find anyone who will talk to me, and I have a viable person. We can't get through. We cannot get through, and we're doing this every day. How is the homeowner, with their lack of information and lack of education about this process, supposed to accomplish this? The other day, I was on the phone with Chase. I was transferred 12 times. And that's after I got cut off twice and had to recall. So the third time, I was transferred 12 times. I was on hold for over 40 minutes. And then I was told that because the person who'd come to see me had been laid off because the employer that they worked for is a RV manufacturer, so they recently lost their job, because they're laid off, that they were not eligible with Chase for any kind of a forbearance or modification, and that I should call back when they have a job. So this is a very difficult set of circumstances that we're operating in. And to me, anything that slows down the process and that requires that we do come to the table, if it prevents only a few, we had a national program that has only generated 25 loan modifications. So I think a state program that saves a few houses is still a worthwhile state program. I am not critical of the loan servicers. I'm not critical of the banks. I think that there's a whole lot of people to blame in this process. I think that the whole the problem is beyond the scope of all of our imaginations. However, given that, we still have this situation that we have to do something with, and I think we do have to protect people who've lost their jobs. The people who are coming to see me have too much debt, a lot of them. They have personal problems that prevented them from addressing their situation before they became delinquent on their mortgages. I'm not saying that these are fine, upstanding, responsible people who've done everything right. I'm saying a lot of them are just those things. I'm saying some of them are and some of them aren't. The point is that we have this problem. And it's not going to go away, and it's not going to get better. And every time this morning I read that Monaco is laying off 2,000 people, and they're a major employer in Lane County. So that means I'm going to get some more phone calls, and there's no funding for my work. So I'm the director of community development and home ownership, and I'm spending about now 60% of my time doing foreclosure counseling, and we get paid a little tiny stipend from the National Foreclosure Mitigation Grant that doesn't begin to pay for the amount of time that we put in. My boss says every day, you've got to quit doing this. We can't afford it. There are only three places in Lane County that do foreclosure counseling. There's NEDCO. There's Consumer Counseling Services, and there's OUR Credit Union that is really not doing it. They didn't even know that they were eligible to do it. So there are three listed.
Thank you, Ms. Hart. I'm going to ask you to summarize if you have any closing comments, because we do have another bill to hear. Anything else you'd like to add?
I just want to say in closing that we can't ignore the problem. There's a lot of homeowners out there in trouble, and if we don't provide every possible avenue, I can only take 8 new cases a week. There are hundreds of people out there getting nothing, and they're left on their own. And we don't have, if I can't see them, I have nowhere to send them. There's nothing for them, and we have to offer them something.
Thank you for your testimony. Sybil?
Chair Bonamy, two members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, also in support of Senate Bill 628. Very much appreciate the time that you've spent considering these issues, and I echo and appreciate the comments of the advocates for the bill who before me. I think what I can add, I work for the Oregon Law Center. We represent low-income people across Oregon, and we've seen an increasing rise in the tide of phone calls from homeowners who are facing foreclosure who have, as has been expressed, been simply unable after time and time again to reach a servicer who can help them look at whether or not their loan can be negotiated. And it ought not to be the case that an attorney needs to get involved before there can be an actual discussion about whether or not that's possible. Often our clients are, in fact, able to get qualify for a loan modification. And if we can use 628 as a method to provide a mechanism by which that mere question can be addressed will provide a great benefit to many homeowners. There are some loans that won't be able to be renegotiated. We recognize that. It won't be the cure for everyone, but it ought to provide a closer look for the circumstances in which there is the opportunity to renegotiate. And then we serve a dual purpose of not only keeping money coming into the lenders, but also preventing the homelessness of many vulnerable families. And so we appreciate that that look. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we have your written testimony as well. Any questions for this panel?
Okay, real quick one.
Go ahead. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Stacey, you're in the trenches, so I want to ask you kind of a question. You brought an interesting situation up where somebody didn't have a job. They'd been laid off. Well, in this bill, how would you envision their loan being renegotiated if they don't have a job? I mean, I have compassion, but at the same time, I'm trying to figure out how you would renegotiate the loan if they don't have income.
My hope is that in this bill, as the servicers are required to come to the table and talk to the people, that they will work more closely with people going in. So it makes sense to me if you have someone, for example, I had a machinist the other day. He was making a lot of money. He was making about $60,000 a year, and now he's drawing $482 a week unemployment. But he's sending out resumes every day. He's going to become employed again at some point. If the servicer is motivated to work with this man, then I'm hoping that this law will prevent a lot of these cases from ever going to mediation, because the servicers will say, like, if we're going to have to talk to them anyway, let's go ahead and talk to them. Okay. Let's try and work something out. It's a long shot, you know. I see this whole situation as being pretty hopeless. So I clutch at anything I can that possibly makes it easier to stem what's going on in our communities.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, committee. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 628 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 510. I'm going to ask Lori to summarize the bill for us, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 510 allows a local government to adopt, amend, and enforce an ordinance, rule, or local law regulating manufactured dwelling park closures or partial closures if it provides the tenant additional equal or more favorable rights and benefits than those provided under current law. Senate Bill 510 prohibits the local government from reducing a tenant's rights and benefits in the context of manufactured dwelling park closures, and it repeals the current preemption provision that relates to amending the rules or ordinances or laws that were adopted before July 1, 2007, declares an emergency. It's effective on passage.
And we have Senator Morissette here. Senator Morissette, would you come on up, please, and bring? Are you going to bring Peter with you? All right, Peter Ferris. All right, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I live in Springfield. This is the foreclosure bill. People who live in mobile home parks and the park is sold out from under them is a foreclosure. They have nowhere to go. It costs a lot of money to move them. This is another shot at something that happened last year. I was not involved in that. I was out of the loop, unfortunately. And there was a bill passed. It was a compromise bill, which you will hear more about by the opponents of the bill, that it allowed six cities that already had things in place to help, to require the park owners to help people move, were allowed to keep them, but it preempted other cities. My city was preempted, Springfield. Eugene was included. There's a huge advantage of living in Eugene. The state of Oregon puts $5,000 into a tax credit. I don't know if that's the way we should be going, if the state should have to pay to have someone moved out of a park or find a new place. Many of the homes in parks are not able to be moved. The other problem is whether or not they can find a place in a in another park. The park in question is a patrician in Springfield. The land was bought by a developer who will eventually put in a conference center. The patrician is a very nice park. The residents are behind me. They are my constituents. They're faced with a foreclosure, an order to move out on 6 months to a year's notice. And I would like it opened up again to other cities who want, it's a choice that the cities would make. The city of Springfield may or may not pass an ordinance similar to the one in Eugene, but that should be a local option. And so what this does is it deprives all but six cities in the state of Oregon of their option to come up with a different solution for helping people move out of a park that's been closed. So with that, I will end and let the experts on the bill.
Thank you very much,
Senator
Morissette. And with your permission, Chair Bonamici, may I ask the other two people who intend to testify today come up?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
You're up.
I'm going to help.
Go ahead and have them come on up.
Just give me a minute, and Dale, you want to do much? You can just sit here.
Need some help? I don't know.
Oh, you're not. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici and the committee. My name is Peter Ferris. I am the executive director and lobbyist for the Oregon Manufactured Homeowners United. I live in Bayview Mobile Home Park in Walport, Oregon, and I'm here to testify in favor of the bill that I drafted. So I want to give you some kind of context to this, and then I'm going to let Gene, who is the president of the Homeowners Association there, talk about the particulars. Last session, we had a very contentious debate about what to do when our communities are closed by development. The big question was whether the legislature was willing to work as partners with local governments to solve a very difficult problem. You arrived at a compromise by grandfathering six local ordinances that had been passed by the end of June of 2007, allowing those six local bodies to amend that ordinance for 6 months and preempting the rest of the state from doing likewise. So you may ask, why do we need to address this issue again? We do so for one good reason, championing good public policy. In this bill, we ask that you allow all local governing bodies to pass ordinances if they so determine it's necessary, and give them the ability to modify their local laws when conditions change. Senate Bill 510 represents good public policy because it empowers local governing bodies that must deal with a situation firsthand to exercise their local control. Clearly, not every local jurisdiction will choose to do so because conditions vary throughout the state. But for those that do, it will give them a way to proactively, fairly, and compassionately deal with the closure issue. It will also empower real participation by a vulnerable population of homeowners faced with the loss of their homes and communities. And while the number of such closures has dramatically decreased, we now face a different set of challenges. Conditions in the park are much more dire because of mortgage fraud, the collapse of the housing and credit markets, the steep rise of unemployment, and significant rent increases. Add to that are others that have hampered us for years. Statutes that favor landlords and little in the way of enforcement of ORS Title 10, Chapter 90. The most troubling of these is the fact that our rents have increased dramatically over the past 10 years in a number of parks. During that time, out-of-state corporations have bought up many of our communities owned previously by mom-and-pops, landlords, and discovered that they could do better by flipping them as the housing bubble mushroomed. In addition to the higher rents, they continue to offer us little service and bare-bones maintenance. And if we complain, we are politically harassed, threatened with eviction, and coerced to sign new rental contracts. I deal with this every week. We need change and a stricter regulation of this industry. We need better enforcement. We need policies that preserve our communities, not eliminate them. The same corrections that are needed on Wall Street are needed here on the main streets of our communities. Last session, we heard from a number of experts who said the problem was intractable, that the landlords were too powerful, and that the status quo would prevail. We proved those experts wrong by amending House Bill 2735 and getting it signed by the governor. We did so by partnering with a few local leaders and legislators who had the courage to step up and work for change with us. Now the city of Springfield plays prominently in this debate. Jane Hewlett, the president of the Patrician Mobile Home Park Owners Association and a former state legislator himself and city councilor, will fill you in shortly about how and why. I mention this because someone who knows about these matters told me last year the city of Springfield will never pass such an ordinance. Well, I found that statement both cynical and self-serving. It goes to the heart of the matter. As a labor and community organizer for a significant part of my life, I know that when people are given a chance to exercise their political power, they will step up even if the sack is decked, the deck is stacked against him. Give us the opportunity and we will prove you right. Let us become part of the solution. Finally, I submit to you that Senate Bill 510 is in the best interest of landlords too. Working with us in the spirit of partnership will enhance their bottom line and promote themselves as real community leaders. Why not be a part of the solution in these perilous times? I urge you to allow the other local governing bodies the opportunity to follow the lead of Wilsonville, Bend, Oregon City, Eugene, Forest Grove, and Clackamas County. Passing Senate Bill 510 out of committee today will represent a second good step in leveling the playing field for 100,000 homeowners in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ferris. And are you Mr. Is it Hute? Did I say your name correctly?
Yes. I don't hear you very well.
Is it Mr. Hewitt?
Yes.
If you'll please state your name and then give us your testimony. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Gene Hewlett. I'm a former member of the House of Representatives. And when I sat in committees, I used to sit at a folding table, and the people sat in folding chairs. I'm surprised to see. I haven't been able to get back up here very many times. Of course, I've been away a good part of my life. In 1963, I was nominated to be United States Marshal for the District of Oregon by President John Kennedy. And after his death, President Lyndon Johnson appointed me to two terms as United States Marshal, 2 4-year terms. And later I was promoted to be Chief of Plans, Programs, Training, and Aircraft Hijacking with headquarters in Washington, D.C. Being a native of Oregon, I could not, nor could my wife, stand Washington, D.C. Besides that, we had a son in college here going to forestry school, and we returned to Springfield. I was raised up the Mackenzie River, and I remember the city of Springfield when there were only 1,200 people there. Now there's over 50 to 60,000 people. Well, anyway, in 1972, I moved back to Oregon and bought a home at the Patrician Mobile Home Park. Well, a few months later, I was elected to the Springfield City Council. I served 2 4-year terms and 2 years as council president. I am presently chairman of the Patrician Park Association, organized under the provisions of Title 10, Chapter 90, 600, 5A. I have my vice chairman here today and a few of our neighbors. I don't know if they want to talk or not, but if they do, I hope they do. Now, that's enough about me, so let's talk about 510. Thank you. I've always believed in fairness through my entire life. Senate Bill 510, as it's written today, is fair, equitable, and impartial. ORS 9645, as now written, is not fair to the $100,000 or 100,000 residents in mobile homes throughout the state. It does not treat the park residents fairly or with equality. Actually, it discriminates. And I think Springfield is being discriminated against. When the legislature in 2007 allowed only 5 cities in one county to adopt ordinances or to amend the ordinances they might have. They were not given ample time to prepare the ordinances. Now, as to 510, proposed and submitted by Senator Bill Morissette, we want to thank Mr. Bill, for his efforts. He was one of the best mayors Springfield ever had, and he is a doggone good senator, and he really works for us, and he represents us well. In order to put this in proper perspective, I relate only a few, and I want to reiterate only a few actual reasons for 510. When the petition was sold, no one was notified, not even the on-site manager, until after the deal was consumed or closed. On January 1st, our park was sold for $5 million to a millionaire. The new owner gave first right of refusal 2 months later, in writing, to the self-appointed consortium of the Springfield Chamber of Commerce. In other words, he sold it. In order for the consortium to proceed and with their redevelopment ideas, they would have to ask for a zone change to commercial. They intended to build a convention center or a conference center and another hotel. The present owner of the Patrician Mobile Home Park owns 529 motel and hotel rooms in the state of Oregon now. Besides that, he just built a seven-story hotel about two blocks from us, and it has a 500-capacity conference room. So why do we need another one? The consortium consisted, and I want you to listen real close, of a former mayor, a former city manager, the present city manager, the community development director, and the present finance director, all of the city of Springfield, and two present city councilors. Some of the members on this consortium, if their plan proceeded, would be called upon to change the zoning. Talk about stacking the deck and potential conflicts of interest. Because of the potential conflict of interest, I have been successful in our efforts to encourage the city manager to resign from the consortium. I wrote him a letter, and I asked him to also relieve his staff people from the consortium, because I felt it was an indirect conflict of interest in case of park closure and for change of zoning. He reluctantly, in the form of a letter back to me, resigned and took the city staff off from the consortium. It took 3 months to encourage the two city councilors to resign from the consortium, along with the encouragement of the editorial staff of the Eugene Register Guard. And they finally resigned.
Mr. Hewlett, can I ask you to wrap up? I know that you have a lot to say, but we want to make sure that there's time for questions and for all the other people who have signed up to testify. Thank you.
Sorry, I'll try and hurry it up.
Okay.
I'll skip some of this. Anyway, I obtained the certified minutes of the Springfield Council meetings for February and March of 2007. At both council meetings, a councilor who is also a member of the Metro Housing Board, who is also, by the way, a member of the consortium, reported on the monthly proceedings of the Metro Housing Board And he was presented with a draft ordinance similar to the one that Eugene City adopted. He claimed he did not have time to get the ordinance to the city council. The same council that sits on the board neglected to present the ordinance to the city council after it was drafted within the appropriate schedule. This council member was invited to attend a meeting of our Petition Park Association. We discussed it from one end to the other. We presented him with a draft copy of Senate Bill 510, and he agreed that it was good public policy and that he would support it.
Thank you. If you could make some closing comments, because we have a lot of people who would like to testify.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll be through here just as soon as I can, but I think it's important that you people understand the plight we're in. And I would certainly urge the passage of Senate Bill 510 as it's written, because it's a closing is imminent. It's just a matter of time. The only thing that this downturn in economy has done is helped us, because it makes it difficult for the owner now to get proper financing to proceed. Now, I want to tell you the park consists of 14 acres, and it's in the gateway area of Springfield. But we urge you to give this a due pass to the Senate and follow it up with support on the Senate floor if it's at all possible. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. And if you have some written testimony there, if we could get copies of that for our records, we sure would appreciate that. And I want to thank you for your service in the legislature and as a U.S. Marshal and on the City Council and everything that you've done. Questions, Kitty? Committee? Do we have questions for this panel? No, thank you very much.
This is transcribed, and can I mail it to the committee?
That would be terrific. Right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Much. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your being here. And I have several names here: Delbert Baird, Vernon Gregg, and Cliff Matthews. Are you all going to testify?
No.
No? Okay, you're here in support, though. And Ed Lee and Anthony Rex Geither, are you going to testify?
No.
Okay, but I noted you checked on the here that you're here in support.
Yes.
And then I have I'm going to call in panels. I have Charles Grief, Chuck Carpenter, Adam. Hold on, just a minute. Let me get this. I have several people signed up as a group here: Chuck Carpenter, Adam Cook, and Troy Brost. And then. Charlie, do you want to come up with John Van Landingham and Pat? Does that make sense? I'm just trying to... people are signed up in groups here, and I'm trying to group people together because we're short on time. So let's have Chuck, Adam, and Troy first.
Thank you.
Former legislators.
I guess it's the hearing for former legislators. Madam Chair, nice to be here with you today. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm the Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 500 manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon. And I have here with me my President and Legislative Chair. I'll try to be brief. There's a couple points that I'd like to make to the committee this afternoon. First off, we're not here to demonize anybody on either side of this equation. I think MHCO and my board recognizes that these are very emotional and difficult issues. We have worked over the last 10 years through what we've referred to as a landlord-tenant coalition, and I think that coalition is responsible for drafting and working with the legislature on a number of what I think are very good pieces of legislation, although some of my landlord members probably would disagree with me on that. but they represent significant compromises in how we approach landlord-tenant law in Oregon. There was an abandonment process that we came up with back in the late 1980s, elimination of subsequent sale in 1999, mandatory training for managers in 2005, and the community closure bill in 2007, to name a few of the pieces of legislation that that coalition has worked on. That group is represents both residents and landlords, and as I've said, we've come up with some relatively good compromises over the years, and we would encourage the committee to recognize that that work is significant, that the compromise we reached in 2007 was a good compromise. Nobody was happy with it. Our membership was very unhappy with that compromise. But I think it's important for the committee to understand that that compromise is a national model at this time, and it represents the most generous compensation program for people who live in manufactured home communities who are unfortunately have to find other communities to live in, other housing alternatives. The state of Oregon and the landlords who own these communities have come up with the most generous program. In fact, even Peter Ferris, in a committee hearing back in Clackamas County, when Clackamas County adopted their closure statute, admitted to the commission that it was the most generous compensation program for per closure in the state. And I think at this time now it's becoming a role model for other states on the East Coast and the Midwest. I would like to just make a few other comments, one of them being on rent. Rent is very, very reasonable for those living in manufactured home communities, and I would point to the fact that very often when a community closes, the main issue is obviously people having to uproot themselves and move to another housing alternative, but very, very rarely are they able to find a housing alternative that is as affordable as living in a manufactured home community. Typically, the rents in the state of Oregon, depending on where you're living, whether it's in an urban area, rural area, run around $400, $450 to $500 a month, and as low as, in some areas, maybe to $300. There's very, very few alternatives to manufactured housing in terms of the expense of it. And I would encourage the committee to understand that here you have, sitting here today, the landlords that come up here are the largest private providers of affordable housing in the state of Oregon. And to sort of negate agreements that have been made in the past, fair agreements, fair negotiations, I think is really to send a signal to those individuals who are making that investment in Oregon. And we all understand that affordable housing is a challenging issue. It is to sort of give them a slap in the face and sort of create a disincentive for people who are going to build manufactured home communities. The last point I'd like to make to the committee is that rent is not the only thing that pays the expenses. We don't, a community does not depend solely on rent to pay the expenses. And I'll give you an example. Right now, we have a number of members in North Willamette Valley that are dealing with the new EPA rulings on arsenic in water. The ruling has gone from 50 parts per million down to 10 parts per million. We have a number of parks who are faced with the alternative of having to buy expensive filtering devices or hook up to city water to be able to meet the new EPA requirement. The filtering devices represent a $200,000 investment for a community that may have 25, 35, or 45 spaces. Rent is not going to cover that expense. And so very often the community owners are looking to being able to sell their community or close it sometime in the future to be able to cover those expenses. So this is a very complicated issue, and I think that the coalition did its best to reach a fair compromise in 2007. I would encourage the committee to stick with us. We look forward to continuing to work in the coalition in the years to come up with good legislation, but we ask you not to neuter that legislation that we came up with 2 years ago.
Thank you for your testimony, and we'll hear from the others before we take questions. Anything to add? Want to go ahead?
Either of you?
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Adam Cook. Thank you for the opportunity to share my concerns with Senate Bill 510 today. Representing approximately 60 manufactured home communities in Oregon and roughly 40 more in the state of Washington, I'm the president of Commonwealth Real Estate Services, which is one of the largest fee management management companies for manufactured home communities in the nation. My family also owns and operates four such communities in Oregon. I've made a career out of working in this industry as a manager of these properties the past two decades, and I've spent the past 10 years as a board member on Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon and currently chair its legislative committee. I'm also a member of the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition Group, which works together for solutions to problems in our industry. Chuck had stated several of those different items that we've worked on in the past, and of course community closure being the most recent, and is only 2 years old. Our industry faces greater scrutiny each year as legislation increasingly makes it more difficult to conduct business. The rules for the park owners can keep changing, and more regulation and risk associated with manufactured housing, the fewer investors there will ultimately be. The more landlords' backs are pushed up against the wall, the more investors won't see this as a sound investment, which will ultimately lead to a decline in our industry. We need private investors to be interested in doing business in our industry. They create jobs, tax revenue, and provide the only non-subsidized affordable housing in the state. We need to do more for the folks who provide this unique type of housing rather than regulating it to the point where savvy businessmen and women can't make this type of investment pencil anymore and choose to put their money elsewhere. I urge you to keep the laws that was agreed upon by the affected parties in our industry. If the rules on the playing field are going to keep changing after the game has begun, we'll soon find ourselves without investors to purchase our communities when the time to sell becomes necessary. We must continue to negotiate our industry issues at the Landlord-Tenant Coalition meetings, where we find our own common ground for solutions to the challenges we face. We have a newly created state law from last session which doesn't require any fixing. Let's leave it alone. Taking away a community owner's property right is not the way to stimulate interest and investment in affordable housing. Instead, let's look to create more affordable housing by working on solutions and incentives for developers to build additional manufactured home communities. Please keep manufactured housing communities a viable investment option for investors and vote against excessive regulation and no on Senate Bill 510. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And Mr. Brost?
Sam. My name is Troy Brost. I'm the owner of Songbrook Manufactured Home Community in Eugene, and I'm also the current elected president for Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. Often MHCO is what we're referred to. So I'm opposed to Senate Bill 510, and beginning in July of 2005, as the legislative chairman at that time for MHCO, I participated in the only Oregon statewide manufactured home industry landlord-tenant coalition. The goal of this 22-month coalition was an effort to explore bipartisan legislation to create financial certainty to primarily four parties affected by manufactured home park closures. And these parties included the closing landlord, the new developer, lenders, and, of course, the tenants. Had I been asked at the beginning of that first coalition meeting, do you believe manufactured home industry parties can truly negotiate a tenant benefiting park closure financial package? And if I'd been asked that, I would have said, you're out of your mind. There's not a chance that it would ever happen. And of course, through great conversation, through great stimulus between all parties involved, we are where we're at today. Financially speaking, the current law imposes a mandatory fee, which equates to an increase of 5,000% to 9,000% over the former law. And that's imposed upon landlords who choose to utilize the land that they own for a different purpose, thereby closing their land that is a manufactured home park, a manufactured home park business. As this enormous increase has been in effect for just over 1 year, I propose this new law test itself before further change. Admittedly, this enormous fee was and remains a difficult pill for landlords to swallow. Yet the caveat was certainty that law created. Landlords, developers, lenders, and tenants all alike know what to expect if a park closes in the state of Oregon. And the intent of that initial bill was that they would know what the expectations are throughout the entire state of Oregon. Against the support of the coalition, five cities were excluded from House House Bill 2735, and one county as well. Statewide preemption, one statewide park closure law was the certainty that the coalition sought. To my knowledge, every regular participant in the Park Closure Coalition negotiations remains true to their word, and I applaud the coalition for their integrity. Unfortunately, not every interested industry party possessed the desire or the courage to negotiate win-win solutions. I ask that this 2009 legislator, particularly those members who casted their vote during the 2000 session, remain true to their word as well. And I ask you to support the efforts of the statewide manufactured home industry landlord tenant coalition. So do not support Senate Bill 510, as it diminishes the ability of the coalition to work, negotiate, and resolve our industry issues. Thanks a lot for your attention to this matter.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Gerard.
Thank you. I actually, with the chair, heard and we voted on the compromise last session. Mm-hmm. And the question that I have is, during that time, ballot measure 37 was still in effect and your property rights were secured, and yet your industry compromised. Do you feel like you would have compromised if you knew that 2 years from now that you would be back before this committee with a bill to take away your property rights?
I think there's a broader question here, Senator, and that is just the integrity of the process. Mm-hmm. I think the membership, the community owners throughout the state, and the board of MHCO would not be willing to sit down and negotiate any significant long-term solutions to any of our problems. And park closure is not our only problem.
Sure.
I mean, there is a whole, this is a very complicated, sensitive relationship between the landlord, the property owner, and the resident. Both need each other. It's very complicated. And I think that our board and most landlords in the state would not be interested in sitting down and negotiating any solutions to anything if they thought that 2 years from now it was going to be negated or neutered or tinkered with. I realize that you all have a responsibility. You all have a vote. We are not the ones with the vote here today. But there needs to be some integrity to the process so that when we all sit down and we negotiate for 2 years on legislation and then come and brief you on what we've agreed to, that there's some confidence that the lifespan, the shelf life of that legislation will be more than the two-year cycle.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No, it's good.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
I have three more people signed up to testify. John Van Landingham and Pat Schwab. Did I say your name right? And then, Charlie, do you want to come up with them? Even you're not signed in together, but you want to make the best use of our remaining time.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. You want me to go?
Pat, do you want to go first? Yeah. Or John?
So maybe I can, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Pat Schwab and I are kind of a team, and Pat's going to introduce herself, and I'm going to introduce us, and speak for us, which is a rare thing.
Oh, is that right? Thank you for having us here. This piece of legislation is something we fought very hard for. I guess probably you need to know who I am. I know, but you don't. I'm Pat Schwab, and I've been involved with manufactured homeowners for about the last 14 years in various capacities, including executive director and lobbyist. So, John, go from there.
Thank you. John Van Landingham. I represent Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. As Pat noted, she's the longtime representative and leader of Oregon State Tenants Association, now Manufactured Housing / OSTA, which is the oldest since 1977 and largest park resident organization in the state. I've represented low-income tenants in Lane County for more than 30 years. I've also advocated on behalf of affordable housing issues and landlord-tenant matters in the legislature since 1991. Residential landlord-tenant law in Oregon has largely been negotiated through a compromise process with a coalition of landlords and tenants since the early 1980s. In 1977, a separate coalition was formed regarding just manufactured housing park landlord-tenant law. I facilitate both of those coalitions and have done so for at least a decade. You've heard about the bill that was passed last session, 2735. That bill came out of the manufactured housing landlord-tenant coalition. It's not perfect. We tenant advocates would prefer no closures. If we were king and it were legal, we would prohibit closures. But we're not king, and I don't think it's constitutionally possible to prohibit closures, so that's not possible in our minds. As part of that compromise that produced 2735 last session, we tenant advocates agreed to a provision preempting local government regulation of park closures. It's this provision that Senate Bill 510 would amend. Because of our agreement in 2007, we feel that we can't support Senate Bill 510 now. We didn't do that lightly in 2007. We don't do it lightly now. I view myself as a local government guy. I served on the Eugene Planning Commission for 12 years. I chaired the local intergovernmental Eugene Springfield Lane County Housing Policy Board for 10 years. I was a leader on the Eugene Planning Commission when it adopted, in 1989, the first local park closure ordinance. And by far the best for a long time. I chaired the Housing Policy Board in 2006 when it amended or recommended amendments to the park closure ordinance for Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County. All three of those jurisdictions participated in the Housing Policy Board. Former Representative Hewlett referred to that group. We made a recommendation to all three jurisdictions that they regulate park closures in 2006, long before the deadline in 2735 to adopt something. Pat and I believe in the coalition process. It's difficult and it's time consuming. We don't get all we want and we don't get it as quickly as we want. But we believe in the long run, it's in the best interest of tenants. We've got a bill this session that will be introduced that will, we think, again, advance the rights of tenants, this time by requiring landlords to register on an annual basis and to pay a registration fee to fund the mandatory education and registration obligations that this coalition negotiated and you adopted in 2005. Next session, we hope to have a bill furthering the provisions for submetering of utilities and addressing issues regarding park purchases by residents. So the coalition process, while not perfect, is something that we think works, something that we're committed to. I have a couple of other short notes. I understand that cities don't like preemption. I didn't like preemption when I was a planning commissioner. I understand that the League of Oregon Cities, Linda Ludwig's in the back of the room, in the interest of time, we agreed that I would remind you that there's a note, a letter in your stuff saying just that. The city of Wilsonville probably says just that. And the city of Eugene, which asked me how it should take, what position it should take on this bill, would say just that also, no preemption. So they all support Senate Bill 510. Secondly, note that Representative Chris Edwards will introduce a bill that will modify the propose to modify the preemption as well, but to allow the six grandfathered local governments to update their ordinances before the end of the year. So it's a modification of the preemption provision. That's important for some cities. Bend, for example, I won't go into that. If you're interested in hearing more about those six cities and how they got to where they are and what they do, I'd be glad to talk about it, but in the interest of time, I won't. Finally, I want to note that we very much appreciate the people who live in the Patrician and the leadership of Peter Ferris. We appreciate his efforts to make the law better for mobile home park residents. We have a deep disagreement with Mr. Ferris on how to do that and on the value of working through a coalition. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grief.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Graff. I'm an attorney in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I represent numerous manufactured dwelling park communities throughout the state of Oregon, have been doing so since approximately 1990. However, I speak here today not on behalf of a particular client, but as an active member of this industry for nearly two decades. As you may have heard, there are two residential landlord-tenant legislative groups. They're charged with the ominous task of trying to reach consensus on residential landlord-tenant issues for any given legislative session. The first group focuses on general residential landlord-tenant matters, the second exclusively upon manufactured dwelling park communities, and I won't even try to get into the detail that John laid out for you because he knows those groups intimately far more than I. I've been a member of the park legislative group since about 1997. However, I understand that The reasoning for the coalition dates back to the early 1980s, when dozens, if not more, contentious landlord-tenant bills would flood the Capitol each session, resulting in an inefficient, inconsistent, and highly contentious way of addressing needed changes in the law. Many legislatures apparently called upon the leadership of landlords, tenants, and others interested in this area to form a group or a coalition and try to reach consensus. We have been following that directive diligently since that time, and for the most part, it has worked successfully.
Mr. Griff, we have your written testimony, so if you can summarize it, then that'll give us an opportunity to ask
some
questions.
I will.
Thank you.
Thank you. To summarize that, during the 07 session, we worked for 2 years leading up to that session on House Bill 2735, and nobody was completely satisfied. There was a lot of give and take, and of course, nobody got everything that they wanted. But the bottom line is, we all participated in this discussion, in this negotiation. Everybody was invited to the table, municipalities, and yes, Mr. Ferris, everybody was invited. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, the House and Senate committees took away some of the landlord benefits that were set forth in the original version of the bill. The only real remaining benefit was that preemption became permanent after a window of opportunity for a select number of municipalities had expired at the end of December, thus making preemption permanent. Senate Bill 510, would take away that remaining benefit. And more importantly, to touch upon the comments of Chuck Carpenter earlier, it would send a signal that our work as a coalition was meaningless, because the very legislature which requested that there be a coalition, in turn, would not support the bill agreed and negotiated in the coalition. Now, I view Senate Bill 510 as an effort by a single individual to impose his will without having to go through the coalition process. He didn't participate in 07, and he didn't participate in this session. And I think Senate Bill 510 merits thoughtful discussion before the coalition and before everybody who is involved in this industry, before it should be submitted to the committee as part of a bill. Unfortunately, it was not brought up to the coalition. It wasn't discussed. We have been at it for many, many months leading up to this point in time, and there's been, again, no discussion or negotiation in good faith. I also think it's worth noting that on the merits of preemption, that has been discussed extensively in the coalition. We came to the conclusion, as part of our negotiated deal, if you will, that there needs to be a uniform park closure, statewide park closure law, in part to encourage park development and investment, and for many other reasons. We rejected a patchwork quilt concept of local regulations, and more importantly, because the real estate market has in recent years plummeted, the number of park closures and conversions has similarly gone down significantly in the last 2 years. So there's no pressing need at this point to even consider Senate Bill 510. But I would invite Mr. Ferris to come to the next coalition meeting for the 2011 session and discuss those issues with the group. We certainly will consider those in good faith, like everything else that is put before us. So I would ask the committee to uphold the integrity of the coalition and the process that we go through, and reject special interests who want to bypass that process, and in the process acknowledge that we have worked extensively and for many, many hours in reaching the deal that we reached in 2735. So for those reasons, I would ask that you vote against this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? I have a question. I guess John would be the best person. Do you get a sense that there are local jurisdictions out there who, but for the preemption, would be passing ordinances that are different from the provisions that were in the 2007 bill?
Sure, Bonamici. I don't think so. I'm probably the source of the earlier reference by Peter Ferris to a cynical comment about whether Springfield would adopt an ordinance, and I base that comment on my conversations with Springfield legislators, councilors. And I know that there was a lot of discussion around the state when park closures were hot 2 years ago. And I think there was a fair opportunity. And as I indicated in my testimony, the Housing Policy Board, which I chaired, recommended both Springfield and Lane County adopt an ordinance. They had more than a year to do so and didn't. The other thing to add is that there's a legal cloud hanging over local regulation right now. And until the Court of Appeals decides that legal cloud, which is that the city of Wilsonville was sued for its ordinance. I said Eugene was the first. Wilsonville's ordinance was much more protective of tenants than Eugene's. I've sometimes described it as Eugene's ordinance on steroids. And they were sued, and the trial court judge in Clackamas County found it unconstitutional. That's been appealed. It's taken a long time to get to the Court of Appeals. They're fighting about everything. Both sides have threatened to appeal it beyond the Court of Appeals. But right now, the Wilsonville ordinance, which is the same ordinance that was adopted by Oregon City and by Bend, has been found to be unconstitutional by a trial court judge. The trial court judge applies to Oregon City, so neither one of those cities can enforce their ordinances. Bend got sued separately in Deschutes County, and to settle its lawsuit, amended its ordinance after the deadline for amending ordinances, so probably unlawfully. And it amended its ordinance essentially to go back to the state law, 2735. So if, for example, the Court of Appeals says, yes, Wilsonville's fine, then maybe other cities might be interested. But there certainly didn't seem to be a lot of interest at the time. Other places were asked to adopt ordinances like Douglas County and didn't. If I might take this opportunity to add one other note to correct something that Charlie said. It's not fair to say that Peter Ferris didn't ask the coalition to consider amending the preemption for this session. He did. The coalition discussed it a number of times, and most notably in one big meeting that the chair attended herself, where we discussed whether we could reach agreement on amending the preemption statute, and we could not.
Thank you. Any other questions? And I do want to note that we did have several things submitted. There's something from Joe Marcheski in Dallas, Oregon, in support, a testimony by Lincoln County Commissioner Bill Hall in support, something from Linda Ludwig, Deputy Legislative Director of Oregon League of Oregon Cities, in support. Testimony in support from Charlotte Lehan, Commissioner of Clackamas County Board of Commissioners. Testimony in support from the City of Wilsonville, Mayor Knapp. And I just wanted to note for the record that those are in our file. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 510 and adjourn for today. Thank you, everyone. This was the next